Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Democrats hold virtually no sway in Washington or in the State House in Columbus or much of the rest of the country for that matter. The demise, according to historian, political analyst and author Thomas Frank, is not because Donald Trump is so great. Frank is the author of several books, including What's the Matter with Kansas? A Critique of Republican Politics, and the 2016 book entitled Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. He joins us now. Welcome to the show, Thomas Frank.
It's great to be here, Ann.
Obviously, listeners, you know, Thomas is on for the hour. He is a critic of Democratic leadership and Democratic control of the party. But we want to hear from Democrats out there. What do you think about the party you belong to? Tell us what you think. We'd like some feedback. 614-292-8513. So, Thomas Frank, is the Democratic Party as we knew it done?
No, you know, I don't want to like catastrophize, right? I mean, it's a bad situation that they're in right now. But it was just when I started writing Listen, Liberal. I mean, one of the reasons I started writing it is because the Democrats in Washington, I live in Washington and I hang around with these people all the time. The Democrats in Washington had a theory where they were going to win every presidential election from here to eternity and they didn't have to worry about anything. This is the theory of they call it the coalition of the ascendant, the idea that demographic changes are going their way. And so they don't have to do anything. They're going to win automatically. And this led to a kind of complacency, I think, among Democrats. But it's also one of the things that triggered me to write this book. You know, they should not be complacent. they have a lot to answer for.
The coalition of ascendants, is that the sort of thing that's like getting marijuana laws passed in states, the things that was pushing gay marriage, that kind of a thing?
No, this is the idea that the ascendant groups in America, the groups that are growing are all Democrats. So and the groups that are shrinking tend to be Republican. But the essential fact about the Democratic Party that I tried to point out in Listen Liberal, in fact, that I've tried to point out for many years in many different forms, is that they aren't who we think they are. This is not a party of working people. This is not even really the party when you and I were growing up, the party that used to care so much about the middle class and would never shut up about it. You know, if you can remember like Lyndon Johnson and Hubert Humphrey and that kind of Democrat. This is a very different group. This group, it's a class-based party. It is founded in the sort of worldview of a particular social class. But that class is not the working class. It's the professional class. It's affluent, white-collar professionals. This is a sociological category. Democrats talk about this all the time. This is not something I came up with by reading the tea leaves or, you know, reading between the lines or being really clever. They talk about this very openly. That's their number one constituency. That's who they care about the most. That's who calls the shots. And that's who all their leadership of the party is. That's where they're drawn from, that class.
I could remember just off the top of my head when Bill Clinton, you know, kind of took over the moderate Democratic mantle of the party.
Yeah.
Back in, I guess, the late 80s, around that time, they met in Cleveland.
The Democratic Leadership Council.
Leadership Council.
Yeah,
right.
That was the name of his faction.
There was a thing.
Yeah.
It was a specific thing. Clearly, labor unions have lost power. The question is what came first, I guess, the chicken or the egg? I'm thinking of, is it a combination of decisions by Democratic Party elites and the mechanization of manufacturing that forged this weaker link?
Okay, that's a really good question. So the big transition in the Democratic Party began right after in the Vietnam War era, right after the election of 68, when you remember the convention in Chicago. I mean, there's riots. People – Democrats are fighting with each other, you know, like fist fighting with each other in Chicago. And so they set up a commission to figure out where the Democratic Party should go. And that commission decided that what they needed to do was remove organized labor from its sort of structural position in the Democratic Party. And the group that the Democrats decided they needed to reach out to were the young people on elite college campuses. And that's who they needed to identify with. And this later sort of became mutated into the ideology of the professional class, the creative class. You've heard these terms
before.
Yeah.
Why did it have to be an either-or proposition?
Well, the you know, you can actually – and I'm, by the way, I'm very – critical of Democrats for making this decision, but it's very easy to understand why they did it in the context of the early 70s. A lot of organized labor, a lot of labor unions had supported President Johnson in the Vietnam War, mm-hmm. and that looked really bad. And there, at the same time, there was no fear among Democratic leaders that, you know, look where we are today, where inequality is growing by leaps and bounds. The middle class society is disintegrating before our eyes. Family farmers are being ruined. All these terrible things happening to people who work for a living. None of that was foreseeable in 1971. You know, that was – nobody saw that coming. So they thought that this was an enlightened move back then. But look, it's led fairly directly to where we are today. That decision that they made in the early 70s to change the nature of the party and to become this party of affluent white-collar professionals.
Did they think they were going to rake in more money because of that? Or was it intellectual, philosophical, this is the right thing
to
do?
At the beginning, it was philosophical. And it still is for a lot of these people. I mean, you know, you look at someone like, well, Bill Clinton has done very, very well in life. And all of these people have, you know, their campaign donations from Wall Street, Big Pharma, Silicon Valley are enormous. Hillary Clinton outraised Donald Trump in the last go-round. It was quite kind of amazing. So it has paid off for them. But what's funny is they actually took this decision. They made this decision before the era of money in politics had really began. I mean, they decided to go this direction in the 70s and, you know, progressively sort of tossed the New Deal philosophy out of the Democratic Party. I mean, this is what I always say is the way I like to put it is when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s, the Democrats were always fighting with each other. There were all these factions. You mentioned one of them, the Democratic Leadership Council. But there were all of these different factions in the Democratic Party, and they fought and fought and fought in those days. But there's one thing that they always agreed on, which was that the Democrats could no longer be the party of Franklin Roosevelt and the party that, you know, this fixation on working class people. They could not be that any longer. They had to be this party. And, you know, these were guys talking about the new economy back in the 70s and the 80s.
They were modernizing the party.
Exactly. Exactly. But they did it in a very peculiar way. They looked at the sort of post-industrial economy that was coming, and they decided they wanted to identify with the winners in this new economic arrangement. Okay. The people on top, the white-collar class. Not the, you know, sort of traditional working class.
So then it became, therefore, a power grab, not a philosophical mission to, you know, the rising tide raises all boats or whatever that is, you know, that it wasn't about helping people. It became about being on the side of the winners.
It's very easy when you're in politics. I mean, every sort of political faction in America believes they're helping out, you know, average people. Everybody thinks that. But, look, I was at the Democratic convention, you know, and they're, you know, here's all these Wall Street guys throwing these parties and sitting up in the skyboxes. And here's the Uber tent out in the, you know, the parking lot. And this is supposed to be the party of working people. And, no way. It's just that's not who they are anymore. I mean, yes, organized labor still supports them, but the support only runs in one direction, if you ask me.
It is a really interesting point, this whole issue, because when I was reading this, I'm thinking money, this is about raising money and running races. But even as recently as whenever Carter ran against Ford, they agreed to take public they agreed not to fundraise outside of the – it's shocking when you think about it. I interviewed Jimmy Carter a year and a half ago or so, and when I was writing his book, that's what recalled it for me. Those were the old days.
Yeah, and so Carter is an important figure in this story, but Bill Clinton is really the critical figure, I think, for the sort of the great big change in the Democratic Party and how they got to be where they are.
And you said, correct me if I'm wrong, of course, but that it wasn't a reaction to Ronald Reagan per se.
The Democrats moved to the right. They would often characterize it that way. But if you look at what Bill Clinton achieved as president, Bill Clinton got a lot of little things done, things that I approve of, little tiny things. But the five big things that he got done, there's five things that he did that his biographers and his friends and his admirers used to boast about in the 1990s. And if you look at them, I'll go through the list real quickly. NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement, the Crime Bill of 1994, which led to mass incarceration.
Three strikes and you're out stuff.
Yep. That's right. Deregulation of Wall Street, deregulation of telecom, the end of welfare. Remember, they abolished the AFDC program and the balanced budget. All five of those things are Republican measures. And all five of them, with the possible exception of the balanced budget, ended in disaster. Every single one of them was a catastrophe. These are things that – and another journalist was digging in the Clinton library and found a memo after one of the many bank deregulation bills Clinton got passed. They were boasting that they got something done that Reagan couldn't. But if you think about it, that's kind of a – everything I just described were things that the Republicans wanted to do but couldn't. NAFTA was actually a Republican trade agreement. But they couldn't get it through Congress. It took a Clinton. It took a Democrat. Same with welfare reform.
There's another thing that a lot of people didn't realize at the time, and that was a secret meeting between Bill Clinton and Newt Gingrich, who was Speaker of the House at the time. They were on the outside, the ultimate nemesis of each other. But you made the salient point that they actually shared a lot more than not.
They had a lot in common.
A lot in common, yeah.
They're pretty much the same generation, came up in the same sort of way, both very scholarly. And they had a series of secret meetings. By the way, it's not secret anymore. It came out. A historian wrote a book about it. They had a series of secret meetings on privatizing Social Security. And they came to a deal. They had figured out how they were going to do it. This is – if you remember the late 90s, and I was writing about this subject at the time, it was in the air. Everybody thought it was coming, that we were going to be made to turn Social Security over to Wall Street in one way or another. And Gingrich and Clinton had this deal. And it was – they figured out how – what it was going to consist of. They figured out how they were going to roll it out, when they were going to get it passed. This is in 1998. And the Monica Lewinsky scandal happened. And they weren't able to do it, which is kind of wonderful if you ask me.
We are talking about the Democratic Party, whatever happened to it. My guest is the author of the 2016 book, Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People, Thomas Frank. He's written an afterword in the 2017 edition of the book that we'll talk about coming up later. In the meantime, I'd like to hear from, you know, let's talk about yellow dog Democrats, people that if it was a yellow dog, you'd vote for them if they were a Democrat, right? People who are true blue Democrats, no matter what, but they lost almost everything in this last election cycle. What happened? Tell us what you think. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. I'll say it again. Democrats hold virtually no sway in Washington or in the statehouse in Columbus or much of the rest of the country for that matter. The demise, according to my guest, historian, political analyst and author Thomas Frank, is not because Donald Trump was so great. Frank is the author of several books, including What's the Matter with Kansas, A Critique of Republican Politics, and the 2016 book entitled Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. He is still with us, so we'd like to hear from Democrats, hear what you have to say about what happened to the Democratic Party. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And by the way, Thomas Frank will be speaking at the Book Loft in German Village tonight. For more information on that, check out our website at wosu.org/allsides. Just going back, you know, you write that the leaders of the Democratic Party in the 70s, 80s, and 90s convinced themselves that they needed to abandon working people in order to serve a different constituency, one of white-collar professionals. And you said they actually uttered these notions. This was
there were books about it, magazine
about
articles. It's easy to find.
And that was pretty much the outcome of the McGovern Commission, which was put together after the 68 debacle. But, you know, they did some good things, you've said, in the McGovern Commission.
Oh, sure. Well, this is, I mean, look,
you.
Well,
the primaries.
Yes, of
for
course.
Example.
They opened up the primary system. Before that, they chose presidential candidates via caucuses and sort of party conventions.
Yeah.
Exactly. And they did away with that and opened up the process. But I want to say something. One last thing about Bill Clinton that I think is very telling, and it really helps to explain how we got to where we are today. Back in the 90s, so one of the ideas of Clintonism is that Bill Clinton could betray this Democratic constituency in that, he could have this famous moment where he insulted Jesse Jackson to his face. He could injure organized labor with something like NAFTA. I mean, actually injure their life chances. And he could do these things and it wouldn't cost him anything because these groups were his friends had this phrase, they had nowhere else to go. Okay, they were what political scientists call captured constituencies. Okay. They don't dare go over to the Republican Party. And this is kind of this gets you immediately to there is a kind of genius to the Trump movement. Trump gave these people somewhere else to go.
Right.
I mean, and he did it by specifically referring to NAFTA, which is still regarded by many working class people as the great betrayal by the Clintons. This worked specifically against Hillary, where it wouldn't, that criticism would not have worked against almost any other candidate because Hillary's husband is so closely identified with NAFTA, and it's still resented all over the country.
But it was also embraced by Republicans.
That's right. Well, they wrote it. It was
exactly.
A Republican
and
treaty.
The Pacific Trans-Pacific Partnership, which has now gone down in flames, was also embraced by Republicans.
I don't think Donald Trump is I think he's kind of I listen to his press conferences and stuff, and he strikes me as kind of an ignoramus. However, there's a sort of genius to this. Can I explain what I mean?
Yeah.
I live in Washington. In Washington, the great sort of idea that hangs over everything is the great God consensus. The idea that the Washington Post and that sort of – that the two parties need to come together in the middle. And one of the issues where – and again, the two parties fight, as we know, fight over all sorts of things. The partisanship is very bitter. But one issue where they did come together and have been together for years and years and years is trade. There was this consensus between the two parties on trade agreements, and you couldn't, criticize – you couldn't get anywhere by criticizing them because the two parties were in complete agreement. And here comes Trump, and before Trump, it was very safe for the Democrats to support free trade agreements even though they injured working class people and they ruined the industrial base of this country, or they helped to ruin the industrial base of this country. Democrats could do that safely because they knew they weren't going to get criticized by Republicans for it. Republicans would never – because Republicans are free traders. Right?
Right.
Here comes Trump and he throws that issue out the window. And all of a sudden we are in a new world where you can hold Democrats responsible for this. And one of the greatest blunders of 2016 – I mean, Hillary saw this coming and she's like trying to get out of it, as fast as she can. She's like, oh, I've changed my mind about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Mm-hmm. I've changed my mind about NAFTA. I've seen the light on these issues. And here's President Obama, a man who I admire in all sorts of ways. But here's President Obama pushing the Trans-Pacific Partnership all through the campaign. What the hell was he thinking? It's like it was so poorly played.
So people just didn't believe her then.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because she was considered.
She tried to get out of it in many different ways. By the way, and this is a continual source of irritation. We're here in Ohio. You might remember in 2008, there was a debate between Hillary and Obama in Cleveland, I believe, where both candidates said that they would renegotiate NAFTA as soon as they became president. Mm-hmm. Obama becomes president. One of the first things he does is he changes his mind on this, compounds the betrayal.
Hillary saw this coming, you said, but she didn't see a lot of other stuff
that's
coming.
Right,
is that the only thing she saw coming?
She was. I think Hillary really. This was a very. It was a lousy effort by the Democratic candidate. She was a weak campaigner, very uninspiring. I mean, her unofficial slogan was "America is already great." It's like something you could find inscribed on a country club logo or something. I mean, it's complacency on wheels. Her sole strategy was hope that the Republican candidate is Donald Trump because he's the only one that Hillary had a chance of beating. And he's the worst presidential candidate we've ever seen in this country, the most unpopular presidential candidate, a man who's like, you know, scandal after scandal after scandal, you know, gaffe after gaffe.
Are we on day 66 or something?
Well, I'm talking about when
the
he's a candidate,
right?
You know, and he goes down the list of American ethnic groups insulting them each in turn. It's like, you don't run for president and do that. The guy's the worst. He has no experience. He doesn't know, like, what's in the Constitution and what isn't. He's not really familiar with the Bible. He's like, what kind of politician is this? And Hillary can't beat him. This is mind-boggling. And she raised and spent twice as much money as this guy.
Yeah, but I mean, even still, I mean, this guy was a television star.
No, he had that going for him. But there's something else going on here. There's something else going on here, which is this deeper question. The long-term shift of the parties. The mm-hmm. Democratic Party shifting away from working class people and middle class people, and the Republican Party reaching out to them, not doing them a whole hell of a lot of good, but reaching out to them in a rhetorical way. Yes, mm-hmm. and Trump connected mm-hmm. emotionally. You can say what you like about him, and I say terrible. I'm not a fan of Donald Trump. And by the way, I've just come back from trips to Europe. In Australia, this is happening everywhere in the world. The same thing, whether you have money in politics or whether you don't. The parties of the left are understand themselves as parties of this enlightened, you know, affluent white collar class. They all talk about innovation and creativity as though that's what politics were really about. And the parties of the right, I mean, look at Marine Le Pen. She's doing exactly the same thing, reaching out to working class
voters. Don't you
think
it's kind of ironic, though, that one of the things that's most memorable of the Clinton campaigns from, you know, the Clinton the first was, is the economy stupid?
Yeah, well, that's right. And that was 1992.
Right.
Clinton was really a turning point. You know, a lot of his when he was coming up, he did sound like a populist. A lot of his advisors, what was the guy from Louisiana? You know,
James Carville uh-huh.
really was a sort of populist figure. But once Clinton became president, of course, I mean, look at the guys that, you know, he immediately turned over the government to Goldman Sachs, basically, you know, Robert Rubin.
Let's hear from some
Secretary
listeners.
Of the Treasury.
Right. John and Galena, you're on the air. Hi, John.
Yeah. Hey, Ann. Hi, Thomas. How you doing?
Great. It's a beautiful day here in Columbus, Ohio.
It's cold.
We're glad you're here. So I'm 26 years old. I'm a farmer and equipment operator up in Galena. I grew up in Appalachia, Columbiana County, and I'm a Democrat. I ran for state representative in a rural district last year. And to me, it's simple. Democrats have got to live by a simple truth. We've got to get back to it. Workers drive this economy. And when workers win, everybody wins. When somebody goes out and earns a dollar and then buys something with it, it gives everybody else a chance to earn that dollar and stay employed. So to me, Democrats have to be the party that puts workers first.
So John,
here.
That starts now.
Why do you think all these people, you know, these, you know, highly educated people in the Democratic Party don't get that?
Well, I think we focus on places where it's easy to win elections, and result of that,
uh-huh.
We win elections where it's easy, and more and more we haven't gone out to and put resources and time and effort into areas that need help and where it's also tough for Democrats to win elections, but. Going forward, that's what we have to do. I mean, there should be a person in every precinct in every county who lives by that message that we as Americans are all in this together. Workers come first. And, you know, we should have a person in every precinct that is the point person for.
Okay.
Can I throw in some comments here? So I recently wrote a story for the Guardian about rural Missouri. I'm from Kansas City originally. I grew up on the Kansas side, but the city is mainly in Missouri. And so I went out to rural Missouri to write about Trump voters there. And this is the area I'm describing is not used to be when I was growing up, not just Democratic, profoundly Democratic. This is Harry Truman country. This is like people have shrines to Harry Truman in their houses and stuff like that, pictures of him all over the place. They regard him as one of the greatest presidents we ever had. These counties went for Trump by 70%. 80%? I mean, extraordinary lopsided victories by the Republican nowadays. And it wasn't all that long ago that this was an area that did vote for Democrats, and not just any kind of Democrats, like Dick Gephardt, populist, left-wing on economic issues, that kind of Democrat. Barack Obama ran pretty well in this part, the part of Missouri that I'm describing. He did very well. Hillary Clinton, there's no support at all. It's getting worse and worse and worse. Now, this is not because it's impossible to figure out how Democrats might reach out to family farmers. It's because Democrats don't want to reach out to family farmers. I was recently reading in the Washington Post, Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee was doing a big study of what they could do to stop the hemorrhaging all over America. You know, a state like Missouri that they used to control and now is so solidly Republican. I mean, they only won like three counties in Missouri now. And they're trying to figure out what to do about it. And you know what their answer is? Walk away from those areas. Stop contesting those areas. Put all your emphasis on the big cities.
Kind of what Hillary did with Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. And it's tragic. They look at those voters in small town. There's just an article in New York Magazine that's symptomatic of this. They look at voters in those small town places and they are like, you know, see ya. They can't understand those people. They don't want to understand those people. If they have anything to say about those people, it is contempt.
It sounds like, you know, from the call, John and Galena, that there are people out there that do. John's got all the creed.
Oh, of course. I mean, no, look, these people are – wait. People are not going to the Republican Party in small-town America because small towns are rich. That is not what's happening. This is a culture that is watching its way of life, you know, blow away in the wind. The small towns I was visiting, these are in a state of ruination. And that's when they're going for the conservative. It's the most extraordinary thing. But the Democrats can't. Well, look, we know the answer. They don't want to figure out how to deal with these people. That's difficult. That would involve, you know, getting away from the Democrats really like who they are. They, you know, they don't want to be told that they've done something wrong. This gets to the other question. Why don't they hear us? You know, I wrote this book. Oh, this came out a year ago. They're not interested. They're interested in foreign countries. The Democratic Party in this country is not interested. Okay, they do not hear this message. They've invented. You go and talk to a Democrat. You pull one off the street in Washington, D.C., and they can recite for you all the excuses for why the Democrats lost the last election and why they need to do nothing different to win next time around. They need to change nothing. It's all because of the Russians. They'll say, you know, or it's all because of that silly FBI inquiry, which is, and these are true. They'll blame their defeat in Congress on gerrymandering, which is true to some degree.
All factors.
These are all, yes, these are all important. But look, two can play at this game. Donald Trump had many more scandals and many more poisonous scandals than Hillary Clinton, and she still couldn't beat him.
Chris in Columbus, you're on the air with author Thomas Frank. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I think that people are getting sicker and sicker of dishonest, lying, scumbag politicians. And I think even Obama was basically George Bush light and kind of betrayed people on the left. And Bernie Sanders, I think, was the first person that seemed like a decent, honest person since who? Jimmy Carter?
Yeah, that's an excellent point.
The DNC was wrong to assume that we just go along again. I mean, we're getting sicker and sicker and sicker of the lesser of two evils.
Yeah. Hey, listen, this is an essential point in Listen Liberal, and I hope you come to my talk tonight and we can talk this over. But when Barack Obama became president, I mean, this was the great, in my mind, 2008, 2009, that was the great turning point in our lifetimes. That was where the country demanded a change in direction. And I thought, and, you know, I may make myself sound like kind of an idiot here, but I thought that Barack Obama was my generation's Franklin Roosevelt. And I was one of the hopeful ones. I was one of the, you know, anxious, excited about Barack Obama. I loved that guy. And he comes into office and basically on the most important question of the day, which is what to do about Wall Street. You know, that's why he was elected, was to get tough with these guys after the financial crisis. And he comes in there and basically continues the Wall Street bailout policies of President Bush. And he doesn't break up any banks, although they richly deserved it. He doesn't prosecute any of the bankers, although the frauds that they were engaged in are self-evident on the face. He didn't even fire anybody. He did fire the chairman of general. When he's bailed out these institutions, he has a seat on the board. He can do whatever he wants there. Roosevelt, by the way, had no hesitation, fired guys all the time. Back in the 80s, George Bush Sr. was putting bankers, fraudulent bankers, in prison after the savings and loan thing. Here comes Barack Obama, hope and change. He can't even do that. This is we came to the turning point historically, and we didn't make the turn. And we are all paying for it. And yes, you're right that Bernie Sanders seems like a breath of fresh air. I live in Washington. 5 years ago in Washington, Bernie Sanders was regarded as a marginal figure, a crank, a risible figure, someone you laughed at. Today, he is the most popular politician in America. I mean, by a mile more popular than President Trump. That tells you something about the times we're living in.
Chris, thanks a lot for that call. Mark in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Quite honestly, it wasn't just the Clinton campaign that screwed up. The DSCC screwed up when they kneecapped Ted Strickland's Senate run and allowed Republicans to focus their attention elsewhere, like on Russ Feingold's seat, which he lost by a narrow margin. They could have given control of the Senate to the Democrats. But they screwed up. It's a broad-based and almost antipathy towards the traditional base of the Democratic Party, the blue-collar people,
who
work for a living. And quite honestly, since Bill Clinton, I've been an independent, and while I vote consistently Democratic, I will not be a member of the Democratic Party.
That's an excellent point. I mean, you mentioned Clinton. We talked earlier about the Democratic Leadership Council. When they don't exist anymore, but when they did, one of their sort of they had this sort of permanent state of war on the word populism. They hated the word populism. And any Democratic candidate who could be described as a populist, the idea was to never support that kind of politician, never support that kind of politics. And so you've got this irony of ironies, the Republican, conservative populism, this sort of right wing populism is romping, is winning all over the place. By the way, I just saw in the paper the other day, Donald Trump went and laid a wreath at the grave of Andrew Jackson, the founder of the Democratic Party and one of the man who sort of launched populism in the world. Here's Trump. It's just like it boggles the mind. And the Democrats are determined to turn away from that legacy. And they will not turn back. They would rather lose than embrace that legacy. They would rather lose than become the party of Roosevelt again.
We're going to turn our attentions to the role of media in all of this when we come back. So tell us what you think about that and the Democratic Party and its demise. It may not be over with, but it certainly has sunk to a new low. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. I think most people would agree that the Democratic Party, can't get much worse after the 2016 general election cycle. A lot of losses, not just at the top, but across the board. States like Ohio, Republicans control literally everything, and they have for a long time. My guest is Thomas Frank. He's the author of the 2016 book entitled Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. It's been reissued. A 2017 edition has been put out with a new afterword by Thomas Frank. He is going to be speaking at the Book Loft in German Village tonight. For more information, you can go to the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Thomas Frank is with us now. Questions or comments? Democrats, what do you think about the party? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And I'm going to turn to Denny in Columbus because he raises the issue of the media. Hi, Denny. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Mr. Frank, I wanted to know, do you rent or are you buying to own in Washington? Are you renting? Are you renting or buying for your home in Washington?
I don't understand what the point of it.
Okay,
let's not be cryptic, Denny. Let's spit it out.
Okay, wait a minute. I want time to get out of it.
Out of Washington? I see.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Yeah, I don't want you to be co-opted by the...
Don't worry. I'm not going to. I'm going the other direction as fast as I can.
Yeah.
So, Denny, what's your question?
But, you know, that... Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
I worry about how this change you speak of, anybody awake has seen it. How much of that is caused by the media consumption in this country?
Hmm.
It seems like they get distracted by shiny objects a lot worse than they used to in the past. And, you know, for instance, 10% increase in defense spending, and 40% decrease in the EPA, that seems like it would be worth looking into a little bit. But they're distracted a lot, it seems.
Okay.
Yep. Well, look, the change that I'm talking about here is the change in the Democratic Party. I mean, obviously, what Trump is doing is disastrous, I think. When you talk about what he's doing to the EPA, you know, this is the wrecking crew back in action in Washington, D.C. But one of the interesting things about, you know, I live in the belly of the beast media-wise. You know, the newspapers are dying all over America. The one place where they're very healthy is Washington and New York. This is the only places. So in Washington, like, you can't swing a cat without hitting a reporter. You know, they're everywhere.
Well, they are,
you know,
pumping it up.
It's the most scrutinized landscape in America. You know, and I'm from Kansas City. Like I mentioned, our newspaper there is shriveled to next to nothing. And the media in Washington has an extremely narrow view of what is permissible in politics, okay? And it's, you know, the truth with a capital T, and I mean the truth for the entire world, for all of mankind, is to be found between the two – somewhere in between the two – the positions of the two American political parties. That's where the truth is. And, you know, they figured this out, and that's who they are, and that's how they see the world. And another really weird thing that I noticed in the 2016 campaign, I wrote a story for Harper's Magazine about the media's reaction to Bernie Sanders, which they were so hostile to him, you know, which really surprised me because he's not a hateable figure. He's kind of a lovable guy, you know, a grandfatherly figure.
Certainly consistent.
Why would someone hate him? And so I went back and did the research and looked at every Washington Post op-ed and editorial about Bernie Sanders and calculated exactly how hostile to him they were. And it was about 5-1 against Sanders as opposed
after
to being
after he announced his candidacy.
Right. This is between January and June of 2016. And what I finally decided, I mean, this amazing hostility and at the same time, this really unreflective love for Hillary Clinton, which is odd, okay? These are the two factions in the Democratic Party. Why would the media line up with just one of them? I mean, they got these reporters. They hired these guys, these op-ed columnists, 20, 30 years ago. These guys have been there for – they didn't hire them because they like Hillary Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
They've all been there, and yet they all share the same worldview. And what I finally decided is that they are part of this same group that I'm describing that is, you know, the Democratic Party, I said, was a class-based party. It's a class party, the professional class. That's who these people are. I mean, I live among them. I live in Bethesda, Maryland, which is a suburb of Maryland. And these people, you know, like Tom Friedman lives down the street from me, the guy, the op-ed columnist for the New York Times. A bunch of the other ones live in that neighborhood as well, and they are very prosperous. And they look at politicians like Hillary, and they see a peer. She is one of them. She went to, you know, fine schools like they did. She got advanced degrees like they did. She is the top of her profession, just as they are the top of theirs. And they look at Bernie Sanders, you know, trying to reach out to you know, a hard-bitten working-class people and young people who are, you know, worried about their future, and they don't get that. That doesn't make any sense to them.
Switching, you know, shifting gears just a bit here, I have two emails, one from Miles, one from Cynthia, and they're both regarding kind of the party identity. Miles writes, Thomas Frank is too correct. Sadly, this is not the party I voted for in 1972, and LGBT identity politics is too niche to be the win-all factor for the millions that voted in 2016. Trump closing the borders will cut off these future Democrats, and the corporate Democrats have bet on and lost. Facebook question from Cynthia. How much of the Democratic Party's troubles come from the refusal of the party to bend its standards regarding moral issues such as abortion and protections for LGBT people?
Well, I'm, you know, I'm pretty liberal on culture war issues. And so I'm not going to find them at fault for taking those positions. I think the Democrats are right to take those positions. But I agree that those are not winners in and of themselves. That they appeal to, I mean, the sort of affluent liberals that I'm describing here tend to be very liberal on social issues and very conservative on economic issues. They have no sympathy, for example, for unions or working class people. And the Democratic Party politics are increasingly a reflection of, you know, that social outlook. And no, that can't win elections by itself. What they are counting on to win elections for them is the shifting demographics. But as I said when we started this conversation, that leads to a kind of complacency. You know, they take all these groups for granted. It doesn't take into account someone like Trump, who is actively going out and courting disaffected Democrats. You know, and the Republicans, by the way, are not going to stop doing that. They've seen now how to win, how to beat the coalition of the ascendant. And it's what Trump did. Think about it this way. Trumpism in the hands of a more capable politician like a Ted Cruz or a Marco Rubio, someone who knows that you don't run for president by insulting every ethnic group in America. Trumpism actually in the hands of a real politician is going to be very hard to stop. And Democrats need to be looking ahead because that's what they're facing in the future.
Mark in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Well, I'm glad you have a guest on who's criticizing the Democratic Party. I've always been a lifelong Democrat, and all the way back from 72, and always consider myself as part of the working class. And I'm beginning to see where the working class is just kind of becoming a nomad. You know, one group of nomads wandering in the desert. Because we were with the Democratic Party in 72. No, actually, in 72, we started splitting off and going Republican for Nixon because of the civil rights laws, I think. And then in 1980, we became the Reagan Democrats. And then in 1992, we were back with Clinton, but then he screwed us. And then the Obama administration came in, and we were back with Obama. But it seems like no matter since then, whichever side gets in, it seems like I get screwed.
I think that's an interesting point, that Democrats shift around, the Republicans don't. Or at least they don't get a moniker
it. They keep moving to the right. But this is absolutely fascinating, you know, what the caller is talking about, that they, you know, the way the Democrats have moved away from the working class. By the way, and this was – I wrote about this in 2004. This is the subject of What's the Matter with Kansas, you know. And when that book came out, Democrats were at first interested. And then they decided that it wasn't really happening. That what the caller just described, there's a whole – I don't know if you're familiar with this. There's a whole sort of genre now of political science writing where I am the great me, Tom Frank. I'm the great enemy, right? And the whole idea of this political science genre is that working class people are not switching over to the Republican Party. And this was this is hegemonic within political science. There's nobody disagrees with this. And it's in the Washington Post all the time. They talk to President Obama. This is – if you ask a political scientist, they will say that what the caller just described is in fact not taking place.
And didn't take place?
Did not take place. Well, they can't say it now. They've been – guess what happened?
Right. I mean, but there were Reagan Democrats.
But I'm telling you that the Democrats have all of these different ways of denying that this is happening, and they will deny it until the day you bury the last one of them in the grave. I mean, they lose and they lose and they lose and they lose, and you take them to it and you point their face at it and you say, this is why they're losing, and they come up with a way of denying it. And then they come up with a way of saying, well, there's nothing we can do about that. You know, there's no way we can appeal to those people. We have to write them off and think of some other way to win. They will come up with any excuse to avoid looking this subject in the face. Why is that? Because this is their great betrayal and they know it. They do not want to look into it. Can I say one more thing on this? NAFTA is a very important milestone in this story of democratic betrayal of working class people, of middle class people. And I've written about this for years. And like I say, I live in Washington. I bring it up all the time. People laugh at me, or they did before this election. They're like, no way. Nobody thinks that's a big issue. Nobody thinks that's important. That didn't cause any jobs to be lost. It's, you know, absolutely no one voted on that. It has never been important, and it's not important now. And look at Trump. Here he comes. And it's just like I have tried for years to point out to these people what is happening, and they dismiss it. And like the caller said, it is obvious to anyone with eyes to see.
Mark, thanks a lot for that call. You know, if you think about things in terms of an algebraic equation, is there any Republican? I mean, I know Republicans who voted for Hillary Clinton this time around.
Yeah.
Is there any? It obviously didn't come close to the number of
no.
People
that's
who
right.
Voted
well,
it's
a big story here that there's more working voted. Class people than there are professional class people by quite a margin.
I mean, in the popular vote, she won by 2+ million
that's right,
votes.
That's right.
But you know, was there a shift for the Republicans in this, in all of this?
Yes, Trump is something new. That turning away from free trade is the main thing. His turn on immigration is new. The fact that he said – I mean, there's a bunch of things that were new. He said in the campaign that he would not touch Social Security and Medicare, which is absolutely new. Republicans have hated Social Security since the day it was passed in 1936. He has been on the warpath against Big Pharma, which is amazing to me. He's criticized the military-industrial complex, these expensive airplanes. All this is new for a Republican.
But he's also on the other side.
Oh, I know. It's all hypocrisy. How much of it does he mean? By the way, a lot of this – now, this is really interesting. I only learned this recently. That's what Le Pen is doing in France. She is also claiming to be a defender of the welfare state. Somehow Trump figured this out. You know, I don't know how. I don't know which of his advisors is like really in with the European politicians. But somehow he figured this out, that this was the secret for destroying the Democrats. And man, it worked. He has the formula.
I'm going to go turn to Canu now in Worthington. Hi, Canu. You're on the air.
Hi, Ian. Hi, Thomas. Yeah, it's Canu here. Just a quick question for the guest. I don't know. I haven't read your book, Liberal Listen, but here's the question. You've been critiqued and really good critiques about Democrats.
Uh-huh.
Can you outline or can you share just about maybe 2 to 3 points what we need to do to go back to the basic, to be the party that value for fight for the small guys and women,
yeah,
and things like that. If you could just outline those things,
so and we have just a couple minutes.
Okay,
to do that.
Look, there's a whole bunch of the issues. Kinda. The issues are not hard to come up with. A lot of the things Bernie Sanders was talking about would be very popular. You know, universal health care, free college. Also, throw in antitrust enforcement. That would be very popular. I think if you made it easier to form a labor union in America, I don't know if that would be popular, but it would change the face of this country, and it would do something about inequality, and it would also reverse the demise of the Democratic Party. The problem is not coming up with the issues. The problem is making the Democratic Party adopt those issues. I mean, these people will not do it. They will not come around to these things. You know, higher minimum wage, very popular. You cannot bring them around on this. They have to be dragged kicking and screaming to victory.
Is there anybody in the Democratic Party you see out there, any kind of standard bearer that you think would get them there? I mean, you know, a lot of what you describe like a Sherrod Brown.
Exactly.
Sherrod Brown. There's
lots of good Democrats out there. That's the thing. Elizabeth Warren's really good. Sherrod Brown is really good. One last point I want to make. In our system here in America, the two parties have a monopoly. In the past, the Democrats would face a challenge from outside. But that's off the table these days. Any change has to come from within.
Thomas Frank, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, I hope to see you later tonight.
We've been talking about Thomas Frank's book from 2016. There's a new edition out with a new afterword. It's called Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. Thomas Frank will be speaking at the Book Loft tonight. For more information, check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks for the calls, thanks for the emails, and thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.